7.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Savitt. I'm with the law firm of Patton Boggs. I represent Ames Construction. With me today I have Caroline Davidson Hood, who's on the brief, and Greg Lauer, who's also on the brief, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Let me briefly just talk about the facts before I before I go into the issues I think that are before the court. In this case, Kennecott Utah Copper had a contract with Ames Construction to construct a tailings impoundment. Kennecott Utah Copper, as part of that construction, Ames was going to install some pipes, some very large pipes. Kennecott Utah Copper also had a contract with an outfit called WL Plastics, where they bought the pipes. WL Plastics had a contract with Bob Orton Trucking to deliver the pipe to the site. On the day this all arose, the Bob Orton Trucking driver came to the site, and because of a requirement in something called a petition for modification, the Ames people were required to escort him to the unloading site, where they left him with another person and told him to stay in his cab. At some point, the driver of the Bob Orton Trucking vehicle got out of his truck, contrary to the instructions that were given to him, unstrapped the load, and one of the pipes fell off and killed him. The Mine Safety and Health Administration issued a citation to Bob Orton Trucking because they alleged that Bob Orton Trucking violated a rule that says that you're not allowed to unload anything in an unsafe manner. They issued a parallel citation to Ames Construction. Ames Construction contested the citation, and the administrative law judge found that although Ames didn't commit the violation, it was nevertheless liable because it was liable vicariously for the act of its contractor, Bob Orton Trucking. As it turns out, that was an erroneous holding. If you look at the administrative law decision, actually, it says this case turns on the sole question of whether Ames was responsible for the acts of its contractor, Bob Orton Trucking. And the conclusion of the case is that it was. So the entire holding of that case is based on a contract.
At the ALJ level.
At the ALJ level was based on a holding based on an issue that was erroneous. It was clearly erroneous. The secretary conceded that it was erroneous. At hearing on appeal before the Mine Safety and Health Review Commission, the secretary advanced a number of new theories. She said, although that finding was completely erroneous, Ames is nevertheless liable because it controlled the area where the unloading was to take place and because it supervised the process. These two concepts are concepts that weren't ever advanced at the trial level.
In your brief responding to that contention, did you say that you had evidence that you could offer that would refute those claims?
Yes, we said we never had any opportunity to provide that evidence.
Did you?
We also said there was no evidence.
Did you say what you might offer to contradict it?
No, we did not, Your Honor. We didn't say what we might offer. The secretary suggested that perhaps that somehow the Kennecott's authority over the contractors on its site was somehow delegated to Ames, and that Ames therefore supervised the area or controlled the area and supervised the process. What they offered, Your Honor, is nothing but a set of safety provisions that they required Ames to follow, something called the Safety and Health Program, it's SHEAP, that they were required to follow. But there's no evidence was in the record regarding the fact of supervision or the fact of control. And frankly, the Mine Safety and Health Review Commission explicitly declined to find that Ames controlled the area. They just said, well, the unloading process has started, and Ames supervised that process, and therefore Ames was liable because it supervised the process. That issue about supervising a process is nowhere to be found in any of the precedents that this court or the Mine Safety and Health Review Commission has ever come up with. In fact, it's to the contrary. What the secretary said to this court in the National Cement case a couple of years ago, and this court, there was a case called National Cement that was decided before this court. In that case, there was a road to a cement plant that went through a ranch. The cement company had an easement on which it was able to own the road, and the cement company was cited for not putting berms and guardrails on the road. Among the arguments that came up was that if this road were a mine road, National Cement might be responsible for people over whom it had no control, for instance, ranch employees who used the road. This court specifically asked the secretary to address that issue, and in the secretary's brief, the secretary said that it would not, that she would not, enforce the provisions of the Mine Act against somebody for the acts of others over whom it had no control. And the court then accepted that explanation from the secretary as assurance that the kind of problem that arose in this case would never happen. So what we're confronted with at the moment is a set of circumstances where there is no control, there's no evidence of control in the record. The issue of supervision is assumed at the appellate level, but not ever found as a finding of fact in the decision below, and a decision that Ames is vicariously liable for the acts of another over whom it had no, with whom it had no contractual relationship, and over whom it had no control.
Can we go to National Cement? What I mean, I'm focusing on the part of the opinion at 795, which imposes indeed a requirement of, or doesn't impose, it quotes commission conclusions, that to be an operator, an entity must have substantial involvement in the operation of the mine. In other words, cannot be held liable unless it operates, controls, or supervises the mine. And I take it you accept that plus the proposition that what an ordinary person would think of as a mine can really be more than one mine, in the sense that there can be more than one firm that operates and controls and supervises some aspect of a single mine.
I think that's fairly well settled.
Okay. So I guess that the question is, I take it you're telling us there is evidence out there which would show that Ames did not supervise or control.
Well, some of
that aspect of the mine described as the unloading of the pipe or the arrival of the pipe.
Yes, Your Honor.
But you said in answer to my first question that Ames did not, in its reply brief, allude to evidence that it would put in on that point to contradict the secretary's claim.
Well, we didn't, at that point, I don't think, in a reply brief before an appellate body, we're responding to arguments that are raised for the first time.
Well, I mean, that is exactly the point that you should. I mean, you're saying that the secretary's pulled a fast one, and if she hadn't pulled a fast one, you would have had material to respond with.
Well, frankly, we thought that not having ever had an opportunity to respond to those issues at the trial level, it would be adequate for us to say we never had a chance to even argue that.
Where is that? I mean, I'm looking at the reply brief. This is starting at JA 256, which is obviously in response to the secretary. By that time, it already conceded that the ALJ's decision was not supported, because that's the first heading of argument number one. Where do you say that you didn't have an opportunity to make the argument below about control or supervision.
I'm searching in my in the brief here, Your Honor. Okay.
I'm not saying you didn't do it, but I don't see it.
I want to make sure I find it correctly. If I can have time pre-rebuttal to make sure I find the exact place rather than taking time.
You can find the place where you say that. You see, we are operating under this provision of 816, which says no objection that has not been urged before the commission shall be considered by the court. So if you didn't argue to them below that you hadn't had an opportunity to make the factual presentation that you want to make.
I will find where we argued it below, but I know we did.
Okay, fine. That's good.
Yeah, we never had an opportunity to bring it up. My time is up, but...
Do you view the decision, the commission, as a rule of strict liability?
Absolutely, Your Honor, but the issue here isn't strict liability, it's vicarious liability. The statute is a strict liability statute, and as the trial court found, the issue here is whether an operator, though faultless, can be liable for the acts of its employees, agents, or contractors. Right. In this case, there's no employee, agent, or contractor that acted. And so when the trial judge quotes language that talks about where the operator, though faultless, you know, although faultless, it can be found liable for the acts of others. I take that to mean that the trial judge found that Ames was faultless, but was only liable because of the acts of Horton.
Well, the commission described the facts on which it was relying for supervision, for fault, but for supervision.
Right, but the supervision, those facts were never findings of fact in the decision. They're just going back to the transcript and rereading it.
Well, NLRB, for example, does this all the time with respect to ALJs. And the ultimate fact-finding that we're concerned about is the fact-finding of the commission, sometime by affirming the ALJ, sometimes not. But if you had an argument that the commission wasn't authorized to find facts and that only the ALJ could, I guess, again, I need to see where that was raised.
I don't know that it was raised. I thought that was implicit, that commission never finds facts. It's a review commission. It's based on the record below, like this court.
What is the provisions in the statute with respect to their authority to make factual determinations?
I'd have to go look that up as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Robin Rosenbluth. I represent the Secretary of Labor. With me at council table is Christian Schumann. It is settled law that the Mine Act establishes a liability scheme under which operators are liable for violations that occur in the mine without regard to fault and without regard to who committed the violation, when the violation is within the operator's control and supervision.
When what? What did you
when say? The violation is within the operator's control and supervision.
Is it and or?
Or supervision. Ames interpretation in this case.
Now, when you say operator, are you talking about production operators and independent contractors?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, Ames was an independent contractor and it was also a production operator.
I thought Judge Garland's opinion in 20 Miles suggests that that's not a viable notion, that you can be both.
But by definition, an operator is someone who can, an owner, lessee, or another person who operates, controls, or supervises a mine, or...
My understanding is there is a distinction between production operator, I mean, we've gone through this in the circuit, I thought, and independent contractor, and that may affect the nature of the liability that can arise with respect to either one.
An independent contractor.
In other words, a liability that can attach to an independent contractor as distinguished from a production operator, I thought, would be different.
Your Honor, some independent It's well established that an independent contractor can supervise or control an area of the mine, but certain independent contractors may not supervise or control an area of the mine.
Finding on the commission didn't rely on controlling the area. That's what the dissent
the,
was
the about. Judge, the judge below made that finding.
The commission. So
the commission relied
so
on.
That's why I say it's perplexing to me what you're suggesting, because I think production operators is distinguished from independent contractors, and we're not talking about an independent contractor here who has been found to control an area of the mine. That was not what's going on here. So how else can they be liable? We don't assume that an independent contractor is liable in the same way that a production operator, that is owner, lessee, et cetera, can be for the entire mine area.
Well, right? If it's within the independent contractor's supervision and control, the Mine Act creates...
Partly responsible for its own employees. Now, where is the case that says, in our circuit, or your case law that we've embraced, we've had a lot of these, that an independent contractor who is not in control of the area in issue, there's nothing to suggest that's what's going on, can be responsible for the employees of someone else?
The bulk transportation case, which is a commission case, which is cited in our brief, held that an independent contractor was liable for non-employees. In that case, it was the independent contractor's subcontractor.
But this is an independent contractor who is, to use the sort of simple legend, production operator.
That is, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Certain independent contractors may not be production operators, but an operator can, the owner of a mine can contract with an independent contractor to supervise and control the mine. And we therefore believe that.
That's not what's going on here.
It is in what's going on because the commission found that that Ames supervised the unloading process. It therefore falls within the definition of a production operator, which is an operator that controls or supervises a mine or part of a mine.
I'm misreading our case law, then. That's not what I understood.
I'm not sure what case law you're referring to.
Again, 20 Mile Coal. We would distinguish between production operators and independent contractors, and they were not the same.
I think the court's decision in Otis Elevator, I'm not sure if it's cited in our brief, but in that case, Congress expanded the definition of operator when it passed the Mine Act in 1977 from an owner-operator or person that controls, operates, or supervises the mine mm-hmm. to include independent contractors performing services or construction at the mine. Under the Coal Act, prior to the expansion of the definition, this court in the Andrus decision and the Fourth Circuit in Bituminous Coal Operators had held that an independent contractor who was performing construction or excavation could be an operator under the old Coal Act definition because it controlled, operated, and supervised a mine. When Congress expanded the definition of independent contractors, this court noted in the Otis Elevator case that it was including independent contractors who did not fall within the Coal Mine Act's definition of operator, but certain operators do control and supervise a mine, as this court held in Andrus, and certainly by expanding the definition of mine operator in 1977, Congress was not intending to limit the responsibilities of those independent contractors.
The Secretary is relying on the first set of words in 3D, running up to or any independent contractor, right? In the Secretary's view, as far as this case is concerned, the independent contractor language is wholly irrelevant.
It could be irrelevant because, yes, this operator...
It is irrelevant, right? Because you're going on the first set of words in 3D.
We are going on...
Which turn on operating, controlling, or supervising. And then the question is whether the record, in a way that is procedurally proper, sustains the conclusion that Ames was such an operator, the kind of operator who operates, controls, or supervises.
That's correct.
A mine. Okay.
However, an independent contractor performing services can also, in our opinion...
You insist on raising that, but that's irrelevant to this case.
It's irrelevant if you find that if the commission's decision is supported by substantial evidence that Ames supervised the mine.
If the secretary is relying on a completely new theory, we'd have to remand, or there are various things we could do. In any event, we couldn't affirm.
Your Honor, the question of whether Ames controlled and supervised the mine was an issue. What was at issue from the inception of this case? Ames understood that. For example, during the opening argument in this case, the secretary stated that the key issue, as she had in her pretrial submission, was whether Ames was responsible for the pipes. And she pointed out...
Responsible for the pipes is kind of vague. It doesn't trigger the magic language, supervise, control, etc.
And in her opening statement, she said that one of the key facts in determining that Ames was responsible was that Ames had control over the mine area, and another fact was that Ames, I believe, had direction over the pipes. When the inspector at the hearing was asked, why did you cite Ames if it was Bob Orton's trucking that unstraps the pipes, the inspector testified, because Ames had ultimate responsibility over this area of the mine. When they escorted the truck driver into the mine and told him where to go and what to do, Ames was directing the truck driver, and direction means supervision.
Okay, and we have in the joint appendix hearing transcript, and there are pages within that where we're going to find
there
the
are, and they're
of the
cited
secretary.
In. They are cited in our brief. All the pages all the points I'm making now are cited in our brief. Ames, in this case, in its post hearing briefs, specifically stated that it asserted its control over the unloading process when it told Mr. K to stay in his truck. Ames stipulated that Orton truck drivers were told to follow the instructions of Ames and to follow Ames's directions about unloading the pipes. In the safety and health plan, which Ames implemented, Ames had the authority to stop unsafe work and to correct unsafe conditions. All of these factors establish Ames' control and supervision over the unloading area, and in fact, they compel the conclusion that Ames did have such authority. And in our brief, I'm sorry, Your Honor, where we go through the substantial evidence begins on page, I think, 40 through...
Yeah, I see 47.
47. The pipe crew members of Ames testified that they had told truck drivers in the past to stop unstrapping their pipes when they saw them doing that. And again, Ames acknowledged it was responsible for the unloading process. And Ames' interpretation in this case, which would make an independent contractor not liable for violations that occur within its control and supervision, is fundamentally inconsistent with the no-fault liability provisions of the Mine Act, And it would, and if it were accepted, it would mean that an operator that is in the best position to protect mine safety and health because it is present at the mine and can observe unsafe conditions and can stop people from taking unsafe actions does not have an incentive under the Mine Act to do so if that person happens to be an independent contractor.
Let me go through the statutory thing again. We'll make sure I understand your position. Operator and production operator are defined identically, except for the fact that the term operator also includes independent contractors, right? So a production operator appears to be an operator that's not an independent contractor.
That's in the Secretary's regulation.
That's the definition of operator. You can rewrite it, we said, means a production operator or an independent contractor, right?
The definition of operator in the Mine Act.
That's kind of what the case that I've been talking about is suggesting. Now, as I read D, it says operator, which includes both independent contractor and production operator, means an owner, lessee, or other person who operates, controls, or supervises a coal or other mine, or any independent contractor performing services.
That's
correct. Now, the reference after the or to independent contractor does not say anything about control or supervise.
That's correct.
Now, how are you getting it there?
We are
to get to a case in which you're going to hold that an independent contractor can be held strictly liable for the faults of the employees of others when that person is not owner, lessee, or other person who operates, controls, or supervises a coal or other mine.
First of all, we do not really read the or after the two parts of the definition in the disjunctive, so that an independent contractor can be both someone who performs services and construction and has control and supervision
again,
over the mine.
Again, you're saying what I think we said you can't say, that is an independent contractor can be a production operator.
Well,
Can I?
I'm trying to understand this.
So my understanding is that there were courts that didn't include within the stuff that is before any independent operator, or any independent contractor, the BCOA court had said that they are included within any other person, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the statute was changed just to confirm that they are included within.
That's what I was trying to make sure. That's how you put it back on the first.
So there still may be a distinction between an any other person, namely an independent contractor who controls and supervises versus an independent contractor who doesn't do any of those things.
Correct.
And our cases have said if you're purely independent contractor and you don't supervise and control, the commission can't go any further.
But you're liable then for your own employees' actions.
Right. But under the cement case, if you control or supervise, then you can be responsible, even if you're an independent contractor.
That is correct.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure how I understood how you were reading that language. All right.
Counsel, I looked at the pages you cited with the thought that the Secretary raised the issue of supervision and control, and that took me to Joint Appendix 19 and 20. And I do see there's a reference, for example, and fifth, Mr. K was on mine property that was under Ames' control. But I have to say that it's certainly not at all clear that the Secretary at this point is invoking the supervision and control provisions of 3D.
And also the inspector testified that the reason he cited Ames was because at the time of the violation, Ames was directing Mr. K and telling him when to unload, and certainly supervision encompasses direction. And again, the fundamental issue as to, and Ames understood control was certainly an issue when it wrote a letter to the Secretary a few months after she issued the citation, asking her to vacate the citation. And in that letter, Ames stated that it was not liable because Ames did not assert, had not asserted its control over the unloading process until it became, at the time of the accident, it had not asserted its control over the unloading process because unloading had not begun. Now, this judge and the commission found that the unloading process had begun at the time of the accident. In fact, Ames litigated this case. Basically, its theory was that unloading had not begun at the time of the accidents, and it lost on that theory, and it has not appealed that part of the decision. However, Ames acknowledged in its post-hearing brief that it asserted control over the unloading process at the time, that it told Mr. K to stay right here, and the accident in this case occurred after that. JA 63. It's a JA 152, which is citing JA 63.
I'm sorry. Where did that go?
I have here the site is at JA 152, citing JA 63. And if my citation is correct, in that part of Ames's post-hearing brief, it states that it asserted its control of the unloading process when Greg Davis instructed Mr. K to wait right here, we'll be right back with a forklift. So the evidence compels the conclusion that Ames controlled and supervised the unloading process. And in this case, the reason that for the no-fault liability scheme of the Mine Act is perfectly illustrated by this case and the reason that it should apply to Ames. Before the commission, Ames took the position that it, even though it was responsible for the unloading process, it was a mere innocent bystander during the process. However, this case perfectly illustrates things that Ames could and should have done and would be motivated to do if the Mine Act applied to Ames. For example, even though Ames observed that when Mr. K brought the truck into the mine, there was not there were no chocks on the truck, which would have prevented the pipes from rolling off the truck, and potentially Ames did not instruct Mr. K about that. It did not tell the person, the one pipe crew member who saw that, Mr. Davis, did not tell Ames to watch out.
Yeah, but as I understand it, you're not resting on a claim that Ames's employees were negligent.
We are not.
Not appear to be the
position.
The
judge did find low negligence. The judge did find low negligence, and Ames hasn't challenged that. However, my point simply is that in this case shows why, even if Ames were, why it is important for the no-fault liability scheme to apply to Ames. And I see that my time is up and absent any further questions.
Further questions? Thank you very much. How much time does the petitioner have? Are you able to find the?
Yes, Your Honor. I found several things. First of all, Section B of our opening brief, and I'm sorry I don't have the joint appendix site, is entitled "The Commission's Decision is Premised on an Incomplete Record." That was our opening brief to the commission, which says it talks about not having an opportunity for us to raise.
I'm sorry. Do you have the joint appendix, sir? You don't have the. Can
no,
somebody lend him the joint appendix? Because mine doesn't say that, and I'm just wondering.
Oh, no, this is our brief to you, actually.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm not looking.
No. It's what happened with the commission.
Yeah, I'm trying to find out what
the
happened.
The commission's brief. Okay, no.
No, not the commission's brief. Your brief to the commission. So the question we're trying to figure out here is whether you raised this issue below, not to us.
And that I have not, I haven't been able, I haven't found, but I'm, okay. Can I, if I can submit it, I will.
We have it. We have it. It's Joint Appendix 256 is your reply brief, and 211 is your opening brief. But we can read it. I just was hoping that you had something.
The section on review by the commission is 30 U.S.C. 823D, three small Roman large C.
That was the one I was
talks about review of the record below.
But it also says that objections not raised below can't be raised.
Yes, it does. You're right. But it also says, but you asked about.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I am. I'm sorry. I'm confused. Say that again.
This also talks about, this is a, describes the review as a review of the record below.
And can you just read it to me? I'm sorry.
823D, three little I, so small Roman three, capital C.
Okay, and could you just read it? Do you have it in front of you? Or, oh, you don't have it in front of you. Okay. Do we have it?
There it is.
I don't want to thank the court for allowing certain kinds of computers to be council table.
Is that like an iPhone, or is that actually a little bigger?
For the purpose of review by the commission under paragraph A or B of the subsection, the record shall include all matters constituting the record upon which the decision of the administrative law judge was based, rulings upon proposed findings and conclusions, decision of the administrative law judge, the petitioner petitions for discretionary review, responses thereto, the commission's order for review, and briefs filed on review. No other material should be considered by the commission upon review. The commission may either remand the case to the administrative law judge for further proceedings as it may direct, or it may affirm, set aside, or modify the decision or order of the administrative law judge in conformity with the record.
Right. So I understand that, and but the commission's decision at 277 to 278 goes through the record below, that is the transcripts, you know, for supporting its proposition that there's supervision or control. So that they haven't gone, I understand your point to be that they could not go outside the record below.
Right.
Yes, I think that's correct. But it doesn't look to me from that recitation that they're going outside. All of the citations are from the transcript.
Are you suggesting that there is a authority to support your assertion that the commission cannot make findings of fact on its own, based on the existing record? Because that is not often the case. And as Judge Garland said, the NLRB can make findings of fact that are at odds with the ALJ, do it all the time.
It certainly has the authority to review the record and review it for substantial evidence.
No, that they can make findings of fact.
That's
routinely done with the NLRB.
It's not. I submit to the court,
because what you just read, I listened very carefully, does not support. It says it can write a new decision. Can either send it back or can write a new decision, which could be.
But it says based on the record below.
No question about that. It can only be based on the record, but it may disagree with the findings of the ALJ.
Even if that's the case, Judge, and I'd hate to see the judge have another bad day. Even if that's the case, the issue of what constitutes supervision, what the threshold is to meet the test, what constitutes control, what the threshold is to meet control, is unknown to anyone at this point, because the secretary has just said, well, this is supervision or this is control. And if you go back to National Cement, it says that control is premised on the ability to withdraw people under what the secretary used as an example was whether the company, or the operator in this case, had the authority to withdraw people from an area pursuant to an order from the agency.
So your contention is they switched the theory of the case on you, and you didn't get a shot at litigating pursuant to that new theory?
Absolutely.
Okay. So it's not that they can't make findings of fact, but that
all
you can do is throw your hands up and say, now Judge Williams has a point that, well, maybe you should say what, but as I understand you now, you're saying it's a brand new theory. I'd have to think about how we're going to litigate it.
Absolutely.
Now, that's what's at issue.
If that was what was at issue, we would have to think about how we would want to litigate it, and we would have, for instance, used the example that the secretary used in National Cement about the withdrawal order. Because in this case,
National Cement was going on control, but National Cement uses the words or, right? Supervision or control.
Yes.
You agree either one of those would be okay?
If either one of those, if I concede that D3 says or other person who controls or supervises. I mean, how can
which includes an independent contractor.
Which includes an independent contractor. But what I'm suggesting to the court is that there's no decision. It may have arisen in the past, but we just don't know it. There's no decision that defines what control or supervision means when there's no contractual agency or employer-employee relationship between the two parties.
But your main point is we should have a shot at litigating if that's the theory.
Absolutely.
Can I just ask one more question? When you were, I've located 823D myself, when you were talking about substantial evidence, is that in that provision or is that, you're using that as an easy substitute for the word on the record?
Right. That's, I'm using it as an easy substitute for that. But
I have one question. What is your response to the passage identified by Ms. Rosenblum? This is page 152 of the joint appendix, and is a sentence from your post-hearing memorandum before the ALJ, and you say, Ames asserted its control of the unloading process when Greg Davis instructed Mr. K to wait right here. We'll be right back with a forklift. And Mr. K responded, okay. That appears to be an acknowledgement of control. Now, maybe it's control in some other sense, but it...
What I'd ask the court to read is, rather than the word control, look at the word asserted and look at the facts. Mr. Davis told Mr. K to stay right there. Mr. K promptly got out of his truck and did exactly what he was what he was instructed not to do. The question is,
that's what often true for supposedly in control.
Right, but the question is, what control did Ames have? What could Ames have done to prevent him from doing that that has any consequence to him? He's not Ames's employee. He's a contractor of a company that has a contract with the mine operator. The mine operator can take action against him.
Well, they could have barred him from...
They could have barred him, but Ames can't.
So Ames could have barred him from parking in that area or unloading.
Well, there's no... We don't know whether Ames could do that. If Kennicott said, this is the guy we want, I don't think Ames could have done that.
You're saying that's the fight you would want to...
That's the fight we want to have. We haven't ever had it.
Okay. Everybody's going over their time, so I guess it's time for us to go.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case will be taken under submission. Thank you very much.